Well, we sure had a fun time this afternoon roasting Dave, and you know, I spent a good deal of time bashing Dave and his profession of preaching, and you know, here I find myself. So it's kind of ironic, but we had so much fun, Dave, that a lot of people came up after and said they want to make that a regular event. So I hope that's okay with you. You know, I just feel like speaking in public here, probably a good time to just get something out in the open here. You know, a lot of people have been wondering about me and the skateboard and the ollies and all this stuff. And, you know, I've taken a lot of flack from my family. Shannon, you know, she, if I'm outside, she'll, like, you know, park in the garage and close the door before she gets out of her car. And the boys won't come outside. You know, and they're the only people that would think it's totally cool, but they're like, "Dad, you're terrible. Give it up." And, you know, and my dad comes over, he's like, "Greg, you're going to break your neck," you know. And the thing is that when Dave asked me to preach, you know, he doesn't pay us or anything, but he gives us a couple of free counseling sessions. So I went in for mine last week, and, you know, Dave, he digs deep, and you don't always like to hear what he has to say, but he's right on, and he said, "Yes, Greg, it is. It is, basically, this whole thing is just the beginning signs of midlife crisis and whatnot, and it's just manifesting itself in this manner with the hard economic times. Otherwise, it'd be a sports car or a boat or something." So let's hope the economy picks up before I kill myself. Anyway, thank you everyone for coming tonight. It's a real honor to be able to stand up here and have you know, just have the opportunity to speak here. And I just want to thank everyone for coming tonight. The first slide I have up here may seem kind of strange. Like, what does this have to do with anything? But bear with me for a moment. The Job Corps was established during the Great Society years. People may remember back to that or have read about it. The War on Poverty in 1964, around that time frame. It's part of the U.S. Department of Labor, and it's still going strong to this day. You know, they probably didn't have a website when they started, and they've got a great website. And they serve over 100,000 young people each year, at-risk, low-income people that would have a low probability of you know, a very good future. They take them, train them with vocational training, give them free room and board and living expense, basic health services, medical and dental, and take care of these people. It's just a great opportunity. And what do they ask in return? Not much. Just a demonstrated need and a demonstrated willingness to want to better yourself. That's all they ask. And they've got basically one thing that they just require. They just ask one thing: zero tolerance for drugs and zero acts of violence. Those things are just, that's what they ask. And when you think about that, you say to yourself, is that too much to ask? Look what they're giving these people. Is it too much to require just something simple like that? And what would you think about somebody that would take all this, you know, all this stuff is provided for them, and this opportunity and help and hope for the future, if they couldn't do that one thing that was asked? What would you think about them? I just want you to hold that thought as we talk about some things tonight. Jesus' ministry was spread out over a time period of about 3 years. And it's covered in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's interesting, if you go to just one of the books, the book of John, the Gospel of John, and you look at his coverage of Jesus' life, he spends none of it on his childhood like some of the other books. It's only the 3 years. And the book of John has 21 chapters. And starting with chapter 13 is basically the last night of Jesus' life. The rest of the book starting in chapter 13, the last night of his life and the couple days after his resurrection. And interesting to note the significance and prominence John gives to this last evening of his life. If you look at the words of Christ recorded in the book of John, and you just total them up and you look at what percent of them is Jesus talking to his disciples that night at that last meal he shares with them, it's about 28%. And how do I know that? I counted them myself. I just went through my red letter Bible and I counted them. And I counted all of them, and it's amazing. That's almost a third. And Jesus starts the evening. He comes in and he washes his disciples' feet. And then he talks to them. And as I said, the words are recorded there. That's a huge section of the book of John. It's just what he says that night. Well, what does he say? Let's take a look at some of the things Jesus says. This is covered in the book of John, starting in chapter 13. And I just want to highlight some of the stuff Jesus says to them that night. His last night, his last meal with them. John 13, 34 and 35. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, so that you love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. John 14, 15. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. John 14, 21. He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. John 14, 23 and 24. If anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make him our abode with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words. John 15, 9 and 10. Just as the Father has loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. If you love me, keep my commandments. John 15, 12 through 14. And this is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. John 15, 17, this is what I command you, that you love one another. Well, is it easy to see what was important to Jesus that night? Was it easy to see in that what Jesus is asking of them in return? Is Jesus asking too much? Is that too much to ask for what Jesus is going to give them? It's just, that's the one thing he asks of them. And that's recorded in John for us. And let's hold that thought. And right after this recording of Jesus spending that last meal with his disciples, covering about a third of all his words, John records Jesus' prayer that night to God. And this whole prayer is documented for us in John 17. And this takes up about another 8% of all the words recorded of Christ in the book of John. And so, just as we looked at what was the one thing Jesus asked of his disciples, what does Jesus hope and ask that God will be able to help his disciples with in this prayer? Well, let's look. John 17, 9 through 11. I ask on their behalf. I do not ask on behalf of the world, but on those you have given me, And all things that are mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I have been glorified in them. I am no longer in the world, yet they themselves are in the world. And I have come to you, Holy Father. Keep them in your name, the name which you have given me, that they may be one as we are one. John 17, 20 and 21. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but on those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. John 22 and 23. The glory which you have given me, I have given them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them, even as you have loved me. Well, was it important to Jesus that his disciples and the believers after him be united and be as one? It's like the one thing he asked. The one thing he asked on the night he was going to face all this is that those followers of him would be one and be united. That's all he asked. Well, it's something to really think about. Must have been important to Jesus. Must have been important to John that we know that. You can see the redundancy in that. Well, how did it turn out? Well, we read about a major, major event in the early church. As the church spread and the gospel was preached and people followed, it's interesting to note Jesus just stressed over and over to love each other. Followers be one. He didn't give them a whole lot of instructions on the exact, dotting the I's and crossing the T's of what to do. And there arose uncertainty about what to do, disagreements about what to do, how to hold, how to run everything. And about 50 AD or so, this was around 15 or 16 years after Christ died and the church was growing and spreading and had spread to parts of Asia, some people from the church in Jerusalem and Judea went up to Antioch, which is in what is today Turkey, Asia, and said, "Hey, wait a minute, you guys aren't doing it right. You have to first become Jews and uphold all the commandments of the old law. Eating kosher, the circumcision, all this stuff, and then this is like on top of that, and so you're doing it all wrong, and you're not saved if you're not doing this." And Paul was, there was a sharp disagreement there, and couldn't resolve it, and they decided to go down to Jerusalem and work this out, and have a big, what's known as the Council at Jerusalem. What's interesting to us and to be admired by us is how they handled it. And it's written there for us to read. I don't think today we grasp the monumental ideas and differences they were trying to come to struggling with. It makes the stuff we can't seem to get past, kid stuff. This was major stuff, major differences. And as you read that, you see the behavior of the members of the council. They listened. They didn't just talk. They listened to Peter when he told about the things that God had showed him, the things God had showed him when he worked with Cornelius and others. They listened to Paul when he described the amazing things going on. And they listened to all these things, and the discussions of the scriptures, writing and things, and they came to a consensus agreement on what to do. Surely not everyone agreed. Not everyone agreed with everything that was the consensus view. But it's admirable how they listened, how they strove to do what God wanted them to do and came to that conclusion and prayed that they would come to the right conclusion. And again, I say, this is one of the key pivot points in the history of the church. And these guys were victorious. Division was averted. And we'll see as we talk about some of the history after this, they weren't so successful. Different people later on in history. So let's talk about that. The history of the church after the first century. During the time we just described, as we said, they came down from Antioch, which was up in Asia Minor, down to Jerusalem. That was sort of the center of gravity of the church. A lot of the apostles were still there. Peter, others. They went there. That was sort of the center of influence. As we see and find in later parts of Acts and other historical accounts, the center of a lot of things shifted to Rome. Paul and Peter both ended up there. And eventually the center of gravity for the Christian for Christians moved from Jerusalem to Rome, which was the capital of the empire, obviously. And that's how it was for a few hundred years. And during those first 200 years or so, after the first century, the church grew and existed. And as I said, the center of influence moved to Rome. And they faced on and off persecution, sometimes terrible persecution, sometimes not as bad. And finally, in about 300 AD or so, the emperor named Constantine converted to Christianity. And the guy right before him was one of the most cruelest persecuting emperors of all time. But Constantine, when he took over, he declared what's known as the Edict of Milan in 313 AD, and he granted religious toleration, and the persecution basically stopped. And the church, you know, and Christianity and a lot of stuff kept growing in Rome. Well, shortly thereafter, Constantine, as he amassed more and more power and became a great builder of things, he rebuilt the city of Byzantine, and it was so nice, he decided to move the capital of the Roman Empire over there. And it's in the strait there between Asia and Europe, what is now Istanbul, Turkey. And he renamed this city Constantinople, and he moved the capital of Rome there. Well, that was all, you know, magnificent and everything, but it sort of sowed the seeds for what would become the Great Schism of 1054, because, okay, the big church was still at Rome, but everyone else kind of went that way. And so a lot of politics and everything and power went that way. And over the next, you know, several hundred years, the tensions grew between the church at Rome and the church in the eastern part of the Roman Empire there in Constantinople, to the point where it was just getting out of hand, according to Pope, Leo IX at the time, to the point where he sends a delegation to the patriarch, who's in Constantinople, basically telling him he needs to affirm that the church in Rome is the head. Well, So they traveled. That's quite a distance. They go over there, these delegates. And they come to the patriarch, Michael Cerularius, and tell him this, that this is from Pope Leo, that you've got to just kind of back down a bit and just acknowledge, hey, the church in Rome is the head of the church. Well, Cerularius refuses, and so the head of this delegation, Cardinal Hubert, excommunicates him. He says, well, okay, then you're excommunicated. Well, Patriarch Michael said, well, then I excommunicate you. and so it went. And that started the great schism that exists to this day between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches. And that was in 1054. The fundamental division has never healed. It's had times of what you might call, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but not real reconciliation, just sort of, phony, hey, let's get back together. And, but it never has. Yeah, this is the Great Schism, and basically you ended up with two huge churches, one centered in Constantinople, and this is a modern picture today of this building dominates Istanbul, Turkey. It's the Church of Sophia in Constantinople, and that is the St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, or the Vatican, which is... That dome is big enough to stand a football field up on end inside. It's very magnificent. But we have these two big churches that to this day are separated by this schism that began about 1,000 years ago. As I said, there's been symbolic reconciliations, but there's also been real sour points as well. A couple of them listed here. The massacre of the Latins in 1282. Basically, the Western Catholic, if you will, Latins that were merchants in Constantinople. There was tension growing, and the people in Constantinople just massacred them. 60,000 people massacred and killed. Women, children, everything, especially the clergy of the Roman Church, were just killed. There's the Fourth Crusade, which is famous for liberating the Holy Lands, is what they were intended to do. But the Fourth Crusade, the Fourth Crusaders, on their way from, they were supposed to go to Jerusalem and liberate it, but they decided on their way to stop at Constantinople and sack the city. And they did. And, when I hear that word sack the city, I mean, I'm, sack the quarterback. It sounds like, they just teepeed the place and tore it up or whatever. But it's terrible. They destroy a city. And it's brutal. Historians have said that what they did to that city would make the Vandals impressed. They were famous for sacking and pillaging places. It was terrible. Then there's been the times in history where they had symbolic reconciliations. The most notable was in 1965, the year I was born, Pope Paul VI on the right and Patriarch Athenagoras mutually annulled those excommunications of 1054, shook hands. It's one of those famous handshakes of history, but it basically went nowhere. Nothing changed after that. There's still two big divisions there. The division has lasted. So What's the message for us? I've got a short 1 or 2 minute film I want to show. Some may think it's corny, over the top. Others might think, hey, that's pretty cool. Just watch it. It'll be interesting, and we'll talk about it for a few minutes. Vern, did you get these sent? Thank you. Again, the church in Constantinople, in St. Peter's Basilica. Okay, thank you. I think most of you will recognize those two places. I was supposed to go down the street, but most of you will recognize those two places, and I think it's, maybe a bit dramatic way to make a point, but the point is divisions aren't hard to find in Christianity today. Here we sit on a barranca with our building and the one across there. What should we do about it? What's the answer? I mean, I have not the answers. Those are huge questions and huge complicated things. My point tonight is, what does Christ feel when he sees that? The one thing he asked for, mankind didn't deliver. They failed utterly miserably. You don't need to look in the history books for the divisions of churches. Look in the phone book. They're all over the place. And, you know, I feel like, that was the one thing Jesus asked for. Didn't ask for a lot. And yet the believers that followed, it's more divided than just about anything we could think of. Is there hope for the future? Well, I believe so. I believe the first point is recognizing it, looking at the situation and saying, hey, this isn't right. This isn't good for sure. And realizing that must make Jesus sad, the one thing he asked for. And also I think the point is that, I'll just say this in closing, leadership is what is needed in times like these. I mean, one person, I can't go fix that rift. I can't fix the rift over here. It's beyond an individual, but God gave an example of how to deal with crisis. And as I said, I think in Acts 15 is the admirable example that we can look to, how the early church averted division by the wise and sound actions of their leaders. They weren't hot-headed, they weren't pig-headed, they weren't stubborn. They listened and they did what was right and they sought to do what God wanted. Something for us to think about when we have a chance to pick leaders and realize the value of good leadership, because that's what God wants for our church. So that's our lesson for tonight. As we always do, after a lesson, we offer an invitation for anyone that's got a need, a prayer, a desire to be baptized. We'll take this time and you can come down as we stand and sing if you have a need.